The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for June 1st, 2017, the Jared Went to Him edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. In the studio with me is John Dickerson of Face the Nation. Howdy, John.
Hey, David.
And from somewhere elsewhere is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily. I don't know where you are.
Hello, David and John. I am at the Yale Studio. Thank you, Yale Studio.
It's nice to
see you. Did Yale always have a studio?
It has always had a studio. Mm. Well, I don't know about always, but
since the beginning
of time.
Yeah. When it was founded in 1736.
It used to be two Progresso soup cans and a wire.
But, you know, Harvard had one first, I think.
For sure.
Yeah.
On this week's Gabfest, how do you say Schadenfreude in Russian? The delightfully accelerating Jared Kushner scandal. Then Trump pulls out of the Paris Climate Accord, or does he? We're taping before the decision is made. We will talk about what the administration's policy about climate means for the future of the Earth. Then Trump's plan to make America great again by taking us back to 1945. It is a huge success. Russia is now our friend. Germany is now our enemy. We will talk about the surprising finish to Trump's European trip and what has followed from that. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. Do you guys think there is anyone in the world who doesn't fist pump just a tiny little bit at the news that Jared Kushner is in trouble? The Kushner, who is, in my view, all too handsome and all too coiffed, the princeling, is facing a mountain of trouble this week with reports that during the transition, he approached the Russian ambassador, whose name I'm now going to botch and mangle, Sergei Kislyak. Is that how you say it? I think you did just fine. To ask Kislyak to set up a private back channel to Moscow using secret equipment within the Russian embassy. This piles on news of other Kushner Russian dealings, such that he failed to reveal contacts with key Russians on financial disclosure reforms, including encounters with shady Russian bankers. And I would then bracket that by saying, are there any other kind of banker in Russia besides shady?
No.
Do you think there are any who are like Jimmy Stewart style Russian bankers?
Yeah. The Russian ethical banking ceremony. I would love to. Award ceremony.
Do we have any ethical Russian bankers?
Well, Russian bankers who trained at the KGB and are friends with Vladimir Putin, I think, is also perhaps worth adding to your descriptor.
I object to these anti-Russian stereotypes.
Okay.
I think they're actually anti-Russian banker stereotypes.
Fine.
John, why not have a back channel?
Exactly.
Why not?
We have back channels all the time, especially to countries with which we have difficulties. I mean, there were back channels to Cuba and back channels to Iran during difficult negotiations in the previous presidency, but obviously the back channel is not all that matters here. This is a back channel with the Russians who, at the time this was going on, were doing at least two things. One, they just interfered in the election. And so this was an effort to go around, according to the press reports, and that's a really important thing to mention here, is that a lot of the Kushner stuff is stories about what the Russian ambassador reported back home, which, as Michael Morell, the former acting director of the CIA, said, that is not a sourcing chain in which I would put a great deal of confidence. And he's exactly right. So that's a huge caveat to put over this entire conversation. But any meetings with the Russians come under the – or in the context of the fact that they, A, sought to influence the election, and B, were being under sanctions for that, and C, were, if this conversation was about Syria, which is unclear whether that's what it was about. At one point, the White House kind of said that's what they were talking about, but now they appear not to be. The Times reported that that's what the conversation was about, but it's not clear. But let's think in the context of Syria. The United States policy, at least expressed by the Secretary of State, is that the Russians allowed the Syrians to use chemical weapons. Now, that happened obviously after this Kushner meeting, but it's not like Syria and Russia. I mean, we had an active beef with Russia about the way they were behaving in Syria. So it's not just the beef we should, as a country, have had with Russia for trying to meddle in the election, but there were also other reasons to have beef. So the kind of casual nature with which this back channel seems to have been set up seems, as it's been reported, either highly naive or totally out of the context of the moment.
Emily, what are the other problems with it? I can think of about five other problems with it.
Well, it was supposed to be secret, so the Obama administration didn't know about it, and it was during the transition. So you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to wait till it's your turn to be the president. And they were at least – some of the reports talk about Kushner suggesting using Russian equipment to do this, which also seems terribly naive. It all just seems either sinister or naive to the point of just, like, brutal incompetence.
Right. And they have lost the benefit of the doubt that you might give to another administration under similar circumstances, because Michael Flynn, who's doing this, is already so entwined and implicated, because they have sent Paul Manafort, because there's so much other seedy stuff going on that you have to assume or you can't give them the benefit of the doubt that these are useful, bilateral, valuable foreign policy conversations, but that there's something shadier happening. And
Kushner himself didn't come clean about his contacts with the Russians before he got his security clearance. And there are questions about his meeting with the non-shady Russian banker, about, you know, Kushner's own companies and investments. It just – there's all kinds of reasons to be suspicious. And maybe there's nothing to be suspicious about, but we haven't heard anything that clears it up.
Another element of this story that's confusing – I, by the way, don't mind that transition officials are meeting with foreign governments in advance of switching over. I do mind the unsettledness of – and surprising, it's still unsettled. So one of the reasons, separate and apart perhaps from this set of conversations, was Flynn's conversations with Kislyak about the sanctions that President Obama was trying to put on the Russians. And to the extent that Flynn seems to have been saying to the Russians, hey, chill, whatever these sanctions are, we'll get them lifted, or the situation will be different under a new president. That is meddling in. And all, it's never been finally adjudicated whether Flynn and President Trump, then candidate or President-elect Trump, had a conversation in which Flynn said, hey, I'm going to go send him the signal. And President-elect Trump said, okay, that's cool. It's odd that hasn't been – Trump was asked about this at a press conference and gave a weird answer. Anyway, that still needs to be figured out, because obviously then it really is the incoming president meddling in current policy. But just having conversations trying to, like, prepare, that doesn't bother me as much. But there's another thing Reuters has reported this last week, which is, I think, an important piece of news that's been lost a little bit, is that Kushner had at least two conversations with the Russians before the election. What had always distinguished, it seems to me, his meetings, as I understood it, with the Russians was they were all post-election.
Right.
So, but before obviously gets back into the question of, okay, what was the nature of the relationship before the election and so forth. So, and his answer has been, oh, I don't remember. I had thousands of phone calls. That seems a little.
It's amazing that these guys cannot remember. Nobody who works for the Trump administration can remember any contacts with Russians. They can remember lots of other things, but remarkably, the thing they seem to forget is, oh wait, I did meet with the Russian ambassador.
Right.
Thank you for reminding me.
Extending to so many of them now. Right. We can't forget that the Attorney General Jeff Sessions is also implicated in this. Like, it just is very weird. It's like this blind spot, and we're supposed to think, according to the president, there's nothing here. And yet over and over again, these strange gaps appear in people's memories, and we still don't really understand what they were all talking to each other about.
So, John, this Russia scandal appears to be like now a landfill that occupies the entire 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, spilling out on the ellipse behind it. Is it better? I mean, how as a scholar of the presidency, is it possible for this anything to happen while this thing just continues to grow and people continue to dump old tires on it?
Well, that's a problem. You've got three investigations at least going on that are major, House and Senate, and then the Mueller investigation. I actually think the one that's much more damaging to the president and much more constraining and much more potentially ruinous is the question of obstruction and interference. We're about to have testimony next week from James Comey about President Trump's effort to slow down the Russia investigation. That puts the president at the center of the action, as opposed to these collusion questions where the president is not at the center of the action, and where, by the way, no collusion has been shown. There's a lot of smoke. There's a lot of this and that and the other thing, but there's no simple narrative. The simple narrative of obstruction is super clear, and it's you've got a Joe Friday type, although that's not exactly right because there's a lot of back and forth about what people think about Comey, but you've got somebody who's about to go testify. You know, in testimony, context is lost. It's all about what's said in the moment, and it's a very, very possible that James Comey will say something that will be particularly damning and aimed directly at President Trump. And why does that matter? Well, let's say it goes away. everything that the president does, which is like many presidents before him, but multiplied times 10, is an effort to get around the constraints of the presidency, to blow off Congress, to short circuit the judiciary, to act in a system where presidents are constrained from acting. Well, that's essentially what he was trying to do in the obstruction thing. And so I think that that part of the story in itself is dangerous, but also touches on another part of the Trump presidency that I think will be with us basically from now until its conclusion.
Emily, Kushner has been relatively insulated, just going back to the smaller scandal, not the obstruction.
The subsidiary familial scandal as opposed to the giant one.
Yeah. Also, actually, before I get to that, what do you make, Emily, of this conservative take now? Oh, well, collusion, even if there was collusion, it doesn't matter. Collusion is not important, which is a new kind of line you hear coming out.
I don't get that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
How does that work? I've not actually read that, but I've seen people say that's what their line is. But what exactly, how does that argument play out?
I don't understand. I was hoping one of you was going to explain it. That's why I set it up as a question.
Right.
I don't have a rant.
American elections, free and fair. Ha, ha, ha. I guess to play it out, you could argue that we already knew all of this, right? Like, yes, we saw them. Trump called on the Russians, you know, on television to get involved. So, like, what new information do we need? And what? I guess let's play it out. The other part would be, well, everyone, we know that the votes were counted accurately, or at least we think so. And so if the Russians influenced it, then good for them. And if the Trump people traded information with them along the way and kind of helped them along, like, that's all fair play? I don't, what? I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, I guess one argument you could make, and I don't
like that what?
This isn't the argument.
I'm going to package that what?
The high decibel was unnecessary there. Apologies to our listeners.
I guess you could make is this a realist's case? I don't know. Or maybe a historical case. You could say, well, essentially Nixon did a version of this before in 1968. And that Reagan and Casey did a version of this with the Iranians.
Both of those are shocking. Oh.
No, I know. That's my point.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, my point is that he could make the realist case, which is in the course of American history, we've had this kind of thing before. Therefore, yeah, this is bad, but you can imagine making that case.
But the ones in the Nixon case was to not have a Vietnam peace accord, and in the Reagan case it was to delay the hostages. It wasn't to actively meddle in the presidential election to advantage yourself.
It was to advantage indirectly.
Yeah,
right. I mean, is not an argument. I'm not saying this is a
right.
I'm saying the point is that, you know, we've found out stuff about previous presidents and it hasn't ruined them, and so, you know, let's move on. I don't know. I'm making
you're
this
right.
up.
You're
I'm
right.
Making this
you're
up.
Right. You're right.
I'm making it up. But can I just say one other thing? Is that on that idea of circumventing the constraints, that's essentially what it sounds like this Kushner-Flynn meeting with Kislyak was, which is like, oh, these Washington bureaucrat types, they're so hidebound by their rules and their slow, sluggish, non-strategic process. Let's just like cut to the chase and get this thing done. You get that feeling a lot in this presidency that, you know, nobody in Washington thinks strategically and they're all kind of confused by their own weird rules. Let's just, like, everything is a back channel. Presidents have always tried to find back channels because they're furious with how slow everything moves. The problem, of course, is that once you do back channels, everybody's still operating on the front channel. It makes huge mistakes because they don't know what's going on in the back channel. So if this is also, I guess, another point I'm making here is just it's a terrible way to run a railroad because you end up nobody knows who speaks for the administration and people end up lying because they say, oh, well, no, of course, nobody's doing a back channel. And then it turns out they are.
Can I say one more thing about Jared Kushner? So, you know, there's obviously this narrative about Kushner and Ivanka that they are saving us from the worst excesses of Steve Bannon, and we should put up with anything in order to keep them in place so that we can have some fairly lame parental leave policy proposal and some prayer of staying in the Paris Climate Treaty, which may get blown up later today. I just so object to this idea. And it's not that I don't understand the goals of it. I just think that the idea that you have these figures of nepotism who, you know, hand wave to centrist or liberal policy goals, but are actually like very much there trying to make the Trump presidency succeed in policy terms that are extremely right wing, like are so much a part of the Veep aspect of this presidency, where it's just about winning, whatever winning happens to mean on that day. And winning can wildly vacillate depending on who spoke to Donald Trump last. So for all those reasons, I just feel like if Jared Kushner was talking to Russians and he lied about it, and, you know, whether he was being naive or malevolent here, if he broke the rules or did something illegal, then he should suffer the consequences.
Hell yeah. There's also just something about him that is so distasteful. There's something intrinsically about that guy that, I mean, he was a member of the Fly Club at Harvard, which is just, I believe I've heard that, which is the worst of the worst of the elite all male clubs. Ugh. The other point about that I think is really deadly about Kushner, which it kind of relates to the point you were making a second ago, John, about back channels, is Kushner and Trump are both real estate people. And this is a point that I think has been made several times, and I've talked about this on the show before. Real estate people fundamentally have a zero-sum view of everything. That because in real estate, you either get the deal and you get to build on a particular spot, or you don't and you can't. And you win or lose. There are very few deals in real estate which are where everyone gains, where it's a deal you make because both parties are going to be highly advantaged, or all parties involved are going to be highly advantaged. Unlike when you build your factory in South Carolina, or when you start selling it as the thing that you want to sell to the public, where the public gains, you gain, suppliers gain, the workers gain. Real estate doesn't really work like that. Real estate is very mercantilist as an industry generally. And it creates a kind of sense of the world that you only have winners and losers. You don't ever have winners and winners. And that's a really bad outlook. It diminishes. Yeah, it's a really bad outlook to have. It's like it diminishes the value of social capital, the value of cooperation, the notion that we could both get something positive out of an interaction that we had. And I think you see that infect everything that Trump does and everything that Kushner does, is this idea that there can only be one winner and it has to be us, rather than we are all in something collectively.
Hmm.
You're very skeptical of this.
No, well, I don't know. I mean, I was just thinking through the deal that the president orchestrated by Jared Kushner made with the Saudis, which is based on basically, we have a common enemy. I'm going to overlook all these things about Saudi Arabia because of our common enemy, and we will join in cooperation against that common enemy. And so,
That's true. That's a good example. Before we move on, we have some business. First of all, we have a Slate Plus topic today for our Slate Plus lucky subscribers. We're gonna go on the Kathy Griffin scandal. What was it? Was it indeed scandalous? If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/gabfestplus and join so you can hear about Kathy Griffin, which I'm sure you're longing to do. Second, there are a mere handful of tickets left for our live show in Denver next Wednesday, June 7th at the Robert and Judy Newman Center for the Performing Arts. Governor John Hickenlooper, God, I said it again.
Yes.
He has a name. I can't wait to see what happens when I introduce him. Maybe I'll get... Governor John Hickenlooper is going to be our guest for part of the show. You can grab one of those final few tickets at slate.com/live June 7th in Denver. We're really looking forward to it. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. As the climate is bleeding, as Greenland is bleeding, as Antarctica is bleeding,
They're not bleeding, they're melting.
Whatever.
Different fluid.
Have you ever seen Blood Falls in Antarctica? It's a waterfall that is blood red, as though it is bleeding because of the mineral content of the water that flows into it. It's one of my favorite spots in Atlas Obscura, as you can imagine.
That was the most subversive.
Have you heard of Atlas Obscura?
Ad I've ever seen. Have I told you about the Fascination Diary? It's just the kind of thing we'd where we'd mention that nude.
Which is bleeding, also is bleeding.
That's what you should do. You could just like co-brand. Just
you've already mentioned a whistle. Didn't you already mention a whistle stop? Or was that just
that was before the show.
In the badinage before the show? Okay. All right. So President Trump today, this afternoon, when you listen, there will be a decision about whether or not the United States is going to stay in the Paris Climate Accord. Does it matter whether or not we end up leaving, given that the Trump administration is clearly not going to pursue any policies that will reduce our emissions?
Yes, it matters. Symbolic gestures and moves matter. It will embarrass the United States of America, basically in front of the entire world. It will confirm the doubts and fears that a lot of non-Americans already have about our president. And also, under the Obama administration, the United States was really key in pushing for oversight and review mechanisms so that we know the countries are actually living up to their commitments. Without us, it is possible that that will weaken. It's also possible other countries will pull out. So, yeah, even though we know that Trump was rolling back all these efforts to clean up, you know, the environment and reduce carbon emissions, to actually pull out has its own sort of giant weight and meaning.
But Emily, just go deeper on that. I mean, if in fact the Trump administration has no intention of abiding by the limits that the accord recommend to us, if, in fact, they have made it clear they have no respect for it, isn't it like allowing a scofflaw? It's why would the other countries want us in there if we are not going to respect it, we're not going to abide by it, we're not going to work for it to achieve? Doesn't that undermine the treaty more effectively than us at least straightforwardly withdrawing from it and saying we're leaving?
I think that's totally possible, because if we withdraw and leave, then other people will readily, other countries, China, Europe, will jump in and readily seize the mantle of leadership, and it will be our loss and their gain. So maybe it is better to have that kind of out in the open. The other alternative, though, is it's possible that if we stay in, some of these rollbacks and coal industry fantasy will not have staying power. And, you know, even in the next few years, especially as, you know, look, time isn't going to stand still for this. Climate change is going to march on. And our economy, like every economy, is going to have to adjust. And there's like the sort of being part of the group, right? And the way in which the peer pressure of nations might have an effect on us too. But yeah, there is an argument that if we were going to be a terrible scofflaw and like sit there smirking in the corner as our carbon emissions roll up and up and up, that it's better to just have us gone.
This is another symbolic way in which the United States is not connected to other nations. It's just another big symbolic America First moment. And separate and apart from what this does to the deal, it sends a signal to all other countries about America's looking out for itself, going its own way, not held back by agreements, alliances, norms. And that tends to make other countries adventuresome in both the way they protect themselves, in the alliances they make, in the decisions they make, in the things they do, and knowing that America is not going to step in and stop them from doing it. And if this were happening in a vacuum, it would be different. But obviously, the steady drumbeat from the president and from his aides, based at least on the piece that was written in the Wall Street Journal by his national security advisor and economic advisor, it sends this constant signal that will have effects as other countries choose to. And it's a version of what people used to say about President Obama, which is when America doesn't lead, other countries do what they want. Well, this is just a different formation of that. And so I think it'll have those effects. What I was interested in is
a great point, John.
You know, this argument basically that China has to stay in and behave and meet their targets because they have to get rid of all the coal plants that are choking Beijing. But the other countries are going to stay in out of self-interest. And I wonder, is that right? Or is that just sort of the conventional kind of thing you read in the paper?
Well, certainly China does need to reduce pollution because it makes life miserable for people in cities. What's weird is that our own self-interest, even in the rawest sense, is also served by staying in this treaty. We're in a good position to build really strong alternative energy businesses. we're in a good position to wean ourselves from the most egregious forms of pollution, the United States will be economically better off. All these people who work in alternative energy, there are many more of them than work in coal, will have better jobs. There will be more of them. You know, the country will have cleaner power and more of it. It's a bizarre, again, this nod to just this small number of people who work in the coal industry, essentially.
Well, no, it's also Republican donors, right? I mean, there are winners and losers in this, and the people who don't want the economy to shift in the way you're talking about are people in industries that will be, like, severely dislocated and people with real jobs. And there is, like, a sadness and sorrow to that because it affects real people. But the aggregate, the sort of, you know, upshot in the end, if you really look at the whole picture, is exactly what you're saying, right? But for sure, we are letting people with a particular kind of very entrenched power in the fossil fuel industry and the people who work for them to some degree kind of be the tail that wags the dog for the whole country. And it, for sure, it's going to be self-destructive economically and also in terms of like American authority abroad.
But what I don't understand, Emily, is why is the America first? I think there's a really strong America first argument to be made to stay in this and like let's be the best solar country and let's be the best wind, you know, make the best turbines and whatever it is that
we can
do there.
Well, and much of corporate America is behind that argument. I mean, there's a huge ad in a bunch of newspapers, including the New York Times today, from like major corporations begging the president to stay in. There was a really interesting move this week where ExxonMobil shareholders like BlackRock and Vanguard voted against Exxon management to tell Exxon they have to start basically coming clean about the effects of climate change on their industry. I should say that my cousin Steve Mufson wrote about that for the Washington Post. That is how I know about it. So those are ways in which, like we said, there is all this adjusting that's going to go on, and we can, you know, the United States of America can like have its head in the sand and deny for as long as it wants, and that will just mean that it falls farther and farther behind in leading the way out of this.
But John, took a question to you on that, which is why isn't there a stronger Republican move to support to be like, yeah, this is a chance for us to grow a new technology industry, for us to grow a new strong energy industry. Why is it so attached to the, you know, the coal and to a lesser extent oil industry?
Well, I think it would be it's two things. And that case has been made to the president that there would be – that the United States will be at a competitive disadvantage if it withdraws. I suppose the argument would be that the corporations who would make that case or the investors that would make that case, including the 280 different investors representing about $17 trillion worth of assets who wrote a letter saying that this climate change has to be addressed from a purely financial standpoint, that part of the party doesn't have the same sway as those other interests that you mentioned, so that there's a split in the business community. And that split has a powerful political component, which is that public opinion among those most likely to participate and therefore penalize Republican candidates is strongly anti-climate change, strongly anti-elitist, telling us what to do policies. And so this, you would pay a big penalty politically by supporting these policies. Also, one other element of this story is that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has been arguing for staying in. And so you see a nice clash between the promises the president made on the campaign trail and that he made as recently as his last rally in Harrisburg, where he was not saying what he was going to do, but it was pretty clear from the rhetoric and the response from the crowd that this globalist agreement was not the kind of thing anybody believing in America First would be a part of. So it's a push between the president's experts that he's put around him and his base. One thing I tried to ask Secretary Mattis about, but he sort of answered a different question, was that it used to be the position of the Pentagon that climate change was a serious security threat because of the effect it has on destabilizing developing nations or pre-developing nations. And then it just basically creates more chaos and madness in the world. And I don't know what the actual Pentagon policy is on that now. Secretary Mattis instead just talked about the president's position. But I guess my point is that if you think of the people who have sway and who represent kind of more traditional thinking in the administration, Madison Tillerson would be two of them.
Can I make one final point, which is about the perversity of withdrawal? Which one of the arguments made for withdrawing is that by the people who want us to withdraw from Paris is that the world doesn't want us to withdraw from Paris. Like the fact that the very fact that so many countries are desperate for us to stay in is taken as an argument that we should get out, because clearly if these countries want us to stay in, America is getting screwed by this deal, right? If all these if it advantages all these other countries for us to stay in, then it must be a bad deal for us, which is so insane.
Right. Well, the other thing I keep thinking about is, so America First is this slogan because of its history, which is already noxious to me, but it's really turning into America Alone. Like, it's just it's just about kind of like telling other countries to go fuck themselves.
Well,
with the occasional like reach out to some particular, you know, like it's like it's like the mean girl who just like picks one person to coddle at a time, but is like obnoxious to everyone else. No,
America has never been closer to the Philippines, to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia.
That's what I mean. Oh, like once in a while we pat, you know, China on the head, but like meanwhile we're telling Germany, you know, that we
I don't agree. If between Saudi Arabia, UAE, all those nations that were there in his first visit, China, Egypt, like probably there are more human beings in the countries that President Trump has shown excessive affection for than the European countries that he hasn't
shown.
But
he's not showing affection for the people who live there. It's their autocratic strongman leaders who he is palling around with. Let's make a distinction there.
Well, fair enough.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Donald Trump's appearance at the NATO and G7 summits left our European allies irritated, infuriated. The president declined to endorse NATO's Article 5, the commitment to collective defense, which every president since Harry Truman in 1949 has done. He scolded the Europeans for not spending enough on defense. He, as we've talked about, he opposed action on the climate and didn't speak up for the Paris Climate Accords. He absented himself from some of the communal walking and activity.
Did not engage in the shuffleboard game at dusk.
Did not play well with other children. He clearly was more comfortable in the opulent and flattering Saudi Arabia section of his trip than with the European section, the European leg. He left Angela Merkel, the very powerful, long-serving, and smart Chancellor of Germany, declaring that for Germany, the times in which we could fully rely on others, they are somewhat over, signifying that Merkel, at least, no longer thinks of the United States under Trump as being the stalwart and absolute ally that we have been. Emily, there was a really interesting David Frum piece. You don't even need that adjective. Every David Frum piece these days is really interesting. There was a really interesting David Frum piece about the post-war world and pointed out that the basically undergirding principle of the post-World War II world for, you know, until today has been that there's a community of friends. This community of friends encompasses the democratic nations of Europe, the United States, the transatlantic Canada, and a few other countries as well. Japan fits in there, that are entwined economies, entwined in a mutual self-defense. And the basically principles that we are there will be no war between us. There will be no serious diplomatic spat between us. There will be seeking for economic unity and comity between us. We won't have trade wars, and we will gradually increase this unit in size. We will add countries on the periphery to it. And that sort of collective family action will be the unifying base from which democracy and prosperity will grow. And that Donald Trump appears to have abandoned that, or appears to be weakening that and fracturing that.
I don't know if David makes this in his piece, but that was what I was going to say. No, I think it attaches to something that I believe, which is that the symbols and participating in the symbols of these NATO meetings matter in kind of the same way they matter. I guess this is, I'm just basically defining the word symbol, but the same way they mattered in Saudi Arabia, that when you do these little things, mention Article 5, it means you sign on to all the other stuff behind it, everything that you just described that's in David's piece. But it also, I think, sends a signal that you are still under the sway of the common values and common aspirations that went into building that system. And so that in the future, you will act within certain parameters because you share those same common sets of values. And that's what seems so destabilizing, that the president is either not interested in or isn't moved by the common values because the underlying values to them are either not known to him or just not that interesting. He was very into the symbols of Saudi Arabia because he has a different worldview where he says, you know, I go to Saudi Arabia, I praise their hospitality, I praise their culture right off the bat because they're these things I want. It represents a necessary second part of this trip, which is a presidency driven by those things I want versus the kind of fuzzier 70 years of peace in Europe kinds of things, which are more abstract, but which history basically tells us are worth paying attention to.
Well, right. History. Exactly. And I don't see why they're fuzzier and more abstract. They're just fundamental in terms of the nation's self-conception and the way that we've had stability around the world since World War II. And the idea that, you know, Merkel, who has been a player here for such a long time, she's watched, you know, Republican and Democratic administrations in the United States. She's worked with both of them. This is like a new creature she's encountering, which is making her rethink her basic alliances and how she thinks about Germany's role in the world and the United States' role in the world. And that is really remarkable.
Right. The entire goal of the Soviet Union after the war was to unscrew Germany from the United States. That was its principal goal. And Donald Trump has, in a very short period of time, succeeded in advancing that interest, which is still a Russian interest. And it's, you're right. I mean, Emily, it's interesting. Like, why do Trump and the kind of America first piece of this, people behind it, why do they not see the value that in fact that peace and that those alliances just make everybody richer and make the world safer? Why don't they see it?
Because there are losers, right? And so if you're thinking about this from the point of view of American workers whose wages have stagnated, who don't like the jobs that are often available, who truly are like struggling from their point of view, then it's easier to lash out at our relationships and, you know, supposed deals we've made with other countries than it is to think about how to change in some way that would actually like take us all into this like better future where the economy goes through these difficult, dislocating moments like we were just talking about. And I also feel like I more and more just wonder if people who support Trump, if there's this way in which there's a taking for granted of all of this freedom and stability. I mean, I think about it a lot in terms of true information and freedom of the press, like these values which are such pillars of our democracy and actually of people's lives, maybe they do feel like they're fuzzy and abstract because we haven't lived without them for a really long time. And so we don't appreciate what we're risking in some deep way.
Right. That's right. I think that's a really, really strong point. I mean, Trump talking about it's so bad that we're running this. Germany has a trade surplus with the United States. So we have these deficits towards Germany. When in fact, what that means is that basically we're getting incredibly great German products that Americans long to have, better made and more, except for my fridge, which is not one of those company products. So fuck the German people who made my fridge. But besides that.
That's a lot of fridge bitterness. What's your refrigerator doing to you? I don't have strong feelings about my refrigerator.
Well, when you get a fridge of the sort that I have, I'll talk to you about it. but in general, it's because we want their cars and fridges and cranes, and that has made us a richer society. I think the biggest German car factory is in South Carolina. It's a factory just outside of Greenville, South Carolina, which makes BMWs. That's an amazing factory. It's great to have. I think it's because I'm such a globalist I'm so to absolutely benefit from the global economy, and I don't depend on these jobs, which are destabilized by foreign competition, that I feel this way. But it makes me so sad. And that Trump is so ignorant about this makes me furious.
Right. Well, it doesn't feel like there's a really thought through, you know, grounded pulling away from this. It feels like, you know, Steve Bannon woke up in a fever dream and Trump doesn't know enough to stop him.
Why not?
Feels very haphazard.
Why not, John, just reaffirm Article 5? Why not just say it?
Yeah, it is, especially when you know. I mean, look, on the one hand, there is an argument to be made that this is in concert with what previous presidents have tried to do, which is to get other NATO members to meet these targets for the future, to put pressure on them. When you talk to former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, I think I've mentioned this before, he says, look, this has put pressure on the Europeans. They feel other pressure too, rising Russia and in unclear signals from the president about U.S. efforts to push back against Russia. Leads these NATO countries to commit more to the joint defense alliance because, you know, they're worried about Russia doing things. But there are some reasons to play the bad guy. However, you obviously want to keep things in balance. And the balance that exists right now is you have President Trump saying and doing a bunch of things, and then you have the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense saying, no, he still agrees to this. When I asked Secretary Mattis about this, he said, look, when he hired me, I said, if NATO didn't exist, you would have to create it. NATO is crucial. And he hired me and asked me to do the job. So that's the most important thing. And he is probably right about that. Now, we'll see. You know, does America give Patriot missiles to Lithuania this summer because it worries about the Russians? Does America help either overtly or covertly with the cyber attacks that are coming into the Balkans from the Russians? Those would be efforts and ways to push back against Russia and would be a part of maintaining the NATO alliance. So what's the United States actually doing with respect to the maintaining of the NATO alliance versus what the president is saying? But given all of this uncertainty, why not do that? Why? It's because he understands the power of symbols. He just went through a big trip through Saudi Arabia in which he carefully and attentively participated in all of the symbols, including the sword dance and all the rest. So he knows or has been told to know why this matters and yet didn't do it. That seems to be going further than some of the other signals he sent, like upbraiding the NATO leaders at a 9/11 ceremony, which is the only time they've invoked Article 5, which was to come to America's defense. It's also interesting for somebody who started the trip saying he wasn't going to lecture to Saudi Arabia to then come to his allies and deliver them a lecture. So there's some obviously inconsistent things here.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
John, when you and Herr Dr. Merkel are hosting a Stein at Oktoberfest, you'll lean over to her and say, Angela, I have the most wonderful story to tell you. What is that story?
Well, it's not a wonderful story. It's just something I would recommend, which is a piece in that Jonathan Rauch and Ben Wittes wrote for Brookings in the Center for Effective Public Management.
That's a powerful pair.
That is a powerful pairing.
Powerful team there.
Serious brain cells working there.
And it's an argument basically for a rebalancing of the way we look at politics. And we're obviously in a state of high populism. And so basically it's the title of the piece is More Professionalism, Less Populism, How Voting Makes Us Stupid and What to Do About It. It is the balance. It's the counterbalancing argument against the sort of wisdom of the voter. And it makes a strong case and a correct case that the whole point of the American system was that you wanted to have a mix of both elites and the wisdom of common sense, and that it's gotten out of whack and out of balance. And so you need to reassert. I think a few of the sentences will raise the hackles of people who believe in the sort of more populism case just as a kind of rhetorical thing. But the argument is nicely laid out And worth reminding ourselves that this goes back to the absolute founding of the country and the fear of demagoguery, and that it's been a constant struggle in American life. And so we are in the midst of one of those struggles. And so it lays out a prescriptive case for some of the things that should be done to rebalance and come back to and re-recognize the absolute necessity of experts. And it's good. It should be read.
If there were one person who I would submit myself to as an acolyte and I would follow his teachings, it would be Jonathan Rauch. I think Jonathan Rauch is right about everything. I really do. I just think he's
my favorite. He's always wise and brilliant on introverts, which is
really a classic that everyone.
Yes. It really is a great piece.
Emily, what will you tell Angela, your new pal Angela?
I will tell Angela about a piece in the Wall Street Journal by Jennifer Levitz about a really interesting decision by someone I normally am very skeptical of, Governor Paula Page of Maine. Maine's Republican governor has decided to commute the sentences, well, or maybe just do early release for a whole bunch of nonviolent offenders. Why? Because Maine is having a labor crisis for summer jobs. There are 2,300 summer positions in Maine for the tourist season that are unfilled for a variety of reasons. They don't have as many foreign workers this year in Maine as they were supposed to have and as they usually have. And so they're desperate for people to work. So they're letting nonviolent offenders out of jail. This seems to me, not surprisingly, like kind of a great idea. I mean, we'll see. We'll make sure that these people don't, you know, turn into troublemakers, but probably they will be employed and go back into the world and hopefully have a chance to be more productive citizens. And it seems to me like if Maine has a labor shortage, this is an excellent way to try to fill it.
Are they being let out to and explicitly set up with jobs, or those two things are not entangled?
No, they're supposedly being helped to find jobs. Like, the idea is that the state's Department of Labor is going to market the offenders that are out to the workforce.
Sure, that's what every parent who wants to send their kid to summer camp in Maine is like. Staffed by ex-offenders. No, I'm kidding.
They didn't let out sex offenders, drug traffickers, or domestic abusers, 100%. Or others involved in violence. These are low-level, non-violent offenders. They probably would be excellent summer camp
100%.
Counselors.
I 100% support. It was just a joke was there. I 120%
you
support.
You had to make it.
Yes.
Anyway, go Paula Page. Let's hope this experiment goes well.
It's so funny when you say, you realize his name sounds like Paula Page rather than Paul LePage.
Yeah, don't. That's a. Yeah, my own governor's name took me a really long time to understand from listening to NPR. It's Danil Molloy. And I kept being like, wait, Dana? I don't understand.
Well, anyway. Don't even get us started on the governor of Colorado.
The Hickenden and Loopers. I want to chatter two quick things. The New Yorker has a wonderful, totally grim piece by Margaret Talbot this week.
Oh, such a good story.
It's about Martinsburg, West Virginia. It's medium-sized town in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia, and how it is grappling with the heroin crisis. It is just the stories of people who were affected by heroin. First of all, I did not realize, because I'm stupid, that this was no longer an opioid crisis. It's no longer prescription opiates, really, that are the problem.
Both.
It's become, but that heroin is much more the problem.
Yeah.
That people got hooked on opiates, hooked on prescription drugs. Those drugs are now too expensive, and so now they're turning to heroin.
And prescriptions have run out. Yes.
And it's just grim. It's all about, you know, the how many people are ODing and the.
Oh my God, that lead. Oh God, people should go read it. So I won't spoil. Yeah. But yeah, it's heartbreaking.
The death rate is 41 per 100,000 in West Virginia, which is just an insane number of people are dying every year. That's just ridiculous. It's incredible.
Well, and Margaret does such a good job of showing how this, like, is becoming normal almost, that it's become woven into the fabric of the society in a way that makes it really hard to see how they're going to get rid of it.
Right. Yeah, everyone's got Narcan. Everyone's carrying around Narcan. Margaret Talbot in The New Yorker about Martinsburg. Then just another piece, which I was meant to talk about during the show, but I couldn't find a good place to say it. Rebecca Solnit has a piece called The Loneliness of Trump, and it's all about how his sort of isolation from the world, the fact that he has been so rich and so privileged, has really isolated him in a way that makes him deeply lonely. And there's this one paragraph which is really great, which is, equality keeps us honest. Our peers tell us who we are and how we are doing, providing that service and personal life that a free press does in a functioning society. Inequality creates liars and delusion. The powerless need to dissemble. That's how slaves, servants, and women got the reputation of being liars. And the powerful grow stupid on the lies they require from their subordinates and on the lack of need to know about others who are nobody, who don't count, who've been silenced or trained to please. This is why I always pair privilege with obliviousness. Obliviousness is privilege's form of deprivation. Read the Solnit piece. It's a just devastating piece that seems to me very psychologically insightful about Trump.
Where can one find that?
It's in a site called Literary Hub, which I do not know, but it's...
But we'll post the link.
It's great. That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our intern is Kevin Townsend. To engage with us and other listeners, to post questions to us, follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest. Tweet at us there. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. See you next week in Denver. Get tickets to that Denver show on June 7th at slate.com/live.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.